if you have the capability Correct. And the yeah. the people to do it, right? Make sure yeah. someone is designated. Like, you're the person. Yeah. I need you to take the notes. Anything that we say, we should change this. Write that down. Yeah. And then we'll discuss it in a formal after action, post-mortem after, but during the midst of an incident, make sure someone is aware, because everybody else, like, for the most part, people are going to be jobbing out and nobody's going to think, I should write this down. You know, some people may here and there, but if you give someone the task, like, hey, you are the person writing this stuff down, then you're going to be in a good place.
You're listening to Protect It All, where Aaron Crow expands the conversation beyond just OT, delving into the interconnected worlds of IT and OT cybersecurity. Get ready for essential strategies and insights. Here's your host, Aaron Crow.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Protect It All podcast. Again, I say this all the time, but I'm extremely thankful that you guys listen and that I have people that are willing to come and share their experiences, their background, their knowledge in this space, because I think as a community, we're all better by, you know, sharing the lessons learned, the experiences, the trouble, the heartache, all the things that we've experienced over the years. And we all have different stories and experiences. So with that, Daniel, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience? Let us know who you are, a little bit about your background and whatever you want to share in that space.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Aaron. So my name's Daniel Swan. I am the Cyber Incident Commander at Rockwell Automation. So previous to that, when I joined the company in 2021, I worked in the product security incident response team. So I've kind of seen both sides of the coin now as far as enterprise IT and product security. So going back even further, so I've always been interested in computers. It's kind of a thing when I was a teenager. And so, you know, I went to college and then did about a year at a bank and decided to join the Air Force. So I served in the Air Force, active duty for 15 and a half years. I'm still in the reserves and getting close to 20 next month. So
very cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you, man. That's a really cool accomplishment.
Yeah, thanks. So yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to everybody today. I've had some great experiences in the Air Force and then since I've been at Rockwell. And yeah, just talk about kind of why I'm here and what I look to do every day when I come to work.
You know, it's always interesting to me to hear and see, whether it be people that I've hired, people that have worked for me, peers, even my own journey, you know, similar to you in that I started out in IT, I started out in technology, you know, I was interested in it as a kid. I'm probably a little older than you, but that's okay. but, you know, I've been doing this a long time and all of those IT experiences have brought valuable insights into the space. You know, because technology yeah. is technology. A switch is a switch. A router is a router. You know, antivirus is antivirus. Maybe I implement it differently. Maybe my process around it is different. But it's still, I need to understand routing and networking and subnetting and all of those different types of things to really be able to troubleshoot and understand. So how have you seen both, and you've even got some different experiences. So from obviously IT, government and working in the Air Force, as well as in the OT space now that you're at Rockwell, like how are things different? And then also the follow-up to that is like, how are they similar and where do you see similarities across all of them as well?
Yeah, I think one of the things that you kind of touched on there was it's a sum of the whole experience, right? So I really do think that to be really, really good and effective at cybersecurity and, you know, OT security, you got to know a little bit about everything because I think day to day in my role, especially, I never know what I'm going to get or what I'm going to see, you know, so it's the Forrest Gump thing, you know, yeah. box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get. Yeah. It's the same thing in cybersecurity and incident response, especially. But I think as far as the comparisons between the two, I think that with the military and the Air Force specifically, you know, my service there, there was a lot of bureaucracy that you'd have to go through to get things done, you know,
sure.
but once yeah. you got them done, it was great and you had great resources. So, you know, once you got the approval, it was go forth and conquer. And so that was always interesting to me. I had some great experiences doing kind of deployable communications. That was fun because you're just kind of on your own doing your thing and, you know, getting everything taken care of. And so that's obviously IP heavy. I started my career doing satellite communications and then became a cyberspace officer after that. So I got to kind of see the backside of things as far as the transport goes and then look at, you know, more of the details of what's happening over those wires that are sending packets. So, and then with Rockwell, it's a great company as far as collaboration goes. There's no dumb ideas. There were a few times in the Air Force where I brought up something and it was like, that's great, you know, Lieutenant, but we're gonna do something else, which is fine. You know, that's how it rolls sometimes. But sure. Generally in Rockwell, if I bring something up, I'm gonna get an audience, and they're gonna listen to me. And then even if we don't move forward, at least I've kind of gotten that audience. And I've been able to do some great things here and just moving the ball forward for maturing things. So I think as far as comparing the two, more bureaucracy with the Air Force, you know, you gotta get through. But once you're through, you're well resourced and, you know, go move. And with Rockwell, you always get an audience. And then after that, you know, you can move forward and kind of conquer. So
that's a great space to be in. And talking about the, you know, the experiences from, you know, working on the satellite or the transportation layer of that, you know, it aligns with, you know, as I'm training in the past, I've been training people to come in and, you know, how to troubleshoot things and you know, kind of giving feedback and guidance and training, et cetera. But it's always like, you know, I think I've said that 3 times this week on podcast, but you know, you always start troubleshooting at the lowest layer of the OSI
yes.
model.
Like, yes.
You don't troubleshoot the application layer if you're not. Yes. Is it plugged in? You know, yeah. Is the freaking cable plugged in? Like, I'm not troubleshooting IP before I make sure the cable's physically plugged in.
Yeah. And even when you're doing SATCOM, it's like satellite communications. Sorry. You're everything's layer one for the most part. Right. So, you know, that was the best learning opportunity I got was the troubleshooting, because you would have a whole loop of signal right from here to here. And if it didn't get from here to here, you had to go to each point, test point. You know, put your spectrum analyzer up there. Is the signal getting through? If it's not, you go down here. Is it getting through? Yep. If not, you go down here. So I think it's really applicable to process control as well, you know, in OT. And if you got serial connections and stuff like that, you just got to start from here to here and then keep going down until you find the problem. So I agree. You know, you kind of got that like lowest level possible half split method, as they called it. You know, and you just kind of go from A to Z and then from Z to Y and then on down until you get to your problem. So it was really great experience.
Yeah, it was so funny though. I would have people and they would really want to start at the application or at the top layer. And I really had to beat it into their head, because you're wasting time up there. Like,
yeah,
you need to make sure the bottom layers are working. You know, is it physically getting there? Yeah, packets getting there. Okay. Is it routing? Okay. Yeah, it's doing that. And work your way up instead of the opposite way. Because the other way, you could luck out and it could be in the application layer and yeah, you got there fast. But in my experience, especially in OT, most of the time it's down in the lower layers anyways. It's a freaking cable got unplugged, a rat bit through a freaking fiber optic cable or something like that. You're testing the freaking firewall rule and the firewall isn't even plugged into the dang switch. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're like, why is my HMI not working? I'm going to troubleshoot my HMI. And then you go look and it's, you know, it's your switch isn't even plugged in. Ethernet's not connected.
Exactly.
And then it's,
you know, it's also funny on the, when you mentioned the level of rigor and the bureaucracy or the paperwork and the you know, the kind of minutia that it takes to get something done in the military. It's very similar in nuclear environments, working in a nuclear power plant, things like that. There's a lot of places like that. How do you feel about that process? Because, you know, I've been on the opposite side, you know, an extreme, you know, swing in the pendulum in the opposite direction where there is no policies and procedures and it's the Wild West. And the bad thing about that is that they don't do anything repeatedly. They don't have any consistent process or procedure.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, well, did you do this? Well, yeah, I did it 3 months ago, but I haven't done it since. So how do you, I'm sure you've probably seen both sides of that coin as well. What are your feelings on extremely over process and extremely under process, and where in the pendulum do you like in the middle?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing to do in any instance, right, is to document what you're currently doing. If you don't have anything documented, then you don't really know how your organization is working. So even if you are very immature and you're like, hey, we have a spreadsheet where we're keeping, you know, information that needs to be done. I mean, at least you know what you're doing, right? And where everything is if you know, you have a bad day and you've got to go retrieve information. So I think that you can definitely be over or you can be under, but, and I think there's other people in the, you know, our industry that have said this, but everybody's on a journey, whether you're just getting started with your security journey for your organization or you're super mature and you have, you know, mountains of policies like the government would have, right? There's still things you can improve. And so I don't really have, I think for me, it's anytime I'm going to go somewhere new, I'm going to check the situation out. Like, what do you have documented? Are there things documented? If you don't, let's go through the engineers and go through how are you doing things on a day-to-day or your network security folks or whoever, right? Let's get that on paper to see how you're doing things day-to-day. And then once we've got that, then we can go from there and actually talk about how we can improve what we've got. So whether it takes budget, manpower, or just training knowledge, right? That's one of the things you can do. So I think that's one thing the government does well generally is documentation. Now, keeping it updated for any organization can be tough, especially as complex as our government is, but things are documented well. There's a good process for most things. And so if you're just starting, get what you're doing documented so that you can build off of that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And having that documentation, at least something you can pull off the shelf. I think that next step for me, the interactions I've had, I think the military does this pretty well, and most government agencies do, but it's actual practicing those things. So whether it be a practice exercise, a tabletop exercise, something like that, is actually taking that procedure off the shelf and running through it in a non-volatile environment where I'm going through the motions of, does this process work? It worked great when I wrote it on paper, but let's actually practice this and say, does that make sense? And is this process realistic, at least in a practice scenario? That's kind of the next thing that I see a lot of organizations struggle as they build this documentation, but they don't necessarily take it that next step. And maybe one person did it in his or her mind, and they put it on paper, but they've never actually practiced it. And not all the players even know their role in that thing until they pull it out and start reading it. Like, wow, that's the first time I've heard of that. Okay, let me go try that.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time, obviously, as an incident commander, doing tabletops for the different organizations and businesses within our company. That's one thing that the military did well, exercises. One of the units I was a part of, it was, a very team-focused organization. So you would get there, you would get assigned to a team with your, I was maintenance, so you had your maintenance, your operators, and all that stuff, right? And then you would go through the entire training course together. And then you would go do two exercises and then you would deploy. So you knew exactly what you were supposed to be doing with your training. And then you practice it for your first exercise. You put your lessons learned in there and how you can improve it the next time. And then you do your second exercise. You're going to have less lessons learned. And then you would do your mission for real and deploy. So it's kind of like this cycle where you're building it out. And I see it the same way in a company, just like Rockwell. We have our plan, right, that we've written, obviously, like any company. And then we have a tabletop simulator that we use right now, software that we can use to create new scenarios. That's the thing too, you don't want to just do the same scenario over and over again. And then you want to baseline that though to your incident response plan. And then one of the things people don't do sometimes is they'll just create it, throw it in a closet, and then it just sits there, or a file, right? So you actually want to look at that and update it annually. Because things change quickly. In our industry, and even annually or when a major instance happens and you have things you can take back to improve it, because you're always going to learn something.
Yeah, I was about to say the biggest nugget, I think, after doing these for so long, I agree with you. Every time you do one, you should learn something, because if you're not, you're just going through the motions. Like the whole point of doing these exercises is you should get more efficient. You should find things wrong or ineffective or inefficient in your procedure, in your policy, in your process. And you should be constantly improving that thing and saying, hey, if we change step one and step two, or we add a buffer, or we add a person, or whatever that process looks like, it should constantly be being better. Like the analogy I always give, and we see this all the time in corporate America, we go through, fire tests, right? The fire alarm goes off, the fake one goes off. Hey, we're gonna have a fire test on a Friday, and we go through the motions. We exit the building. We know where the muster point is. We have the team, the floor wardens, and we're making sure everybody's clear. We do this all the time. And why do we do that? It's because we don't want the first time that we're going through this process is when there's an actual fire, because then people panic. They don't know what to do. Then people get hurt. Then people get left behind. Like, that's the type of thing. It's the same thing in cybersecurity. It's the same thing in what these tabletops are supposed to be. It's supposed to be you going through this enough and you frequently enough that when something really happens, hey, I remember we've done this multiple times in a training scenario. You should think, oh yeah, this is my next step, or I've done this before. It shouldn't be the first time you've ever done it.
And I think the other thing too is important that I try to do is even during an event, right, where you're doing it for real, you always want to try to leave at least a little space to learn and capture that, because I always capture stuff as we go after actions, because I don't want to wait till the end of it and look back and go, oh, what was that we felt like we needed to do to prevent this in the future? I don't remember, right? Because it's been, however long, and life's chaotic, crazy, and you're working until 11 o'clock at night to try to get things done. So I always try to leave a little bit of room to learn, So if we have newer folks on the team that we can bring in, level ones, level twos that have never seen something before, hey, come on, you know, you can observe. And because the tabletops are good and those are useful and definitely needed, but the best learning is doing it for real, right?
100%.
Unfortunately, yeah. Unfortunately, right? You know, how that goes for people. And so I've been in this role long enough to where, you know, I'm very well practiced with simulations and regular things that happen, right? So I think it's super important to leave room for growth through and improvement and learning during an actual event. If you have the ability, sometimes it may be something where you don't have the ability because of whatever reasons can happen, right? But always try to leave that if possible.
Yeah, I mean, I just got back from an incident response in the UK, and, you know, same thing. We're there for 9 days, working odd hours, night and during the day, and long shifts, and, you know, working with different teammates and members and contractors, and it was just chaotic in so many ways.
Yeah.
And to your point, like the first day or two, we didn't capture as some of the things that we wanted to. And then we're trying to, you know, sit down as a group. It's like, hey, what were those things that we thought we needed to make sure we remembered? And luckily, as a collective, we remembered them. But then we started going forward, kind of collecting those things as we went at the end of the day, at the end of our shift or whatever. Because to your point, like, again, sometimes you don't know how long these things are going to go. Again, we were there for nine days.
Yeah.
Again, different time zone. We were working different hours, odd shifts in different places that we've never been before. Like all of these things are crazy. So there has to be some kind of rigor that you put into this to kind of capture those things, because some of those nuggets are priceless. They can be the difference in, you know, making sure you close the loop and that doesn't happen again. And oh crap, we forgot about XYZ and now it's happened again. We didn't mention it to anybody and we should have, right?
Yeah, you never want to be in the midst of an incident and go, I feel like I've seen this before and I feel like I was supposed to do something about this.
Right.
And then when you do your after action to your CISO, you know, like in our case, it's like, he's going to be like, didn't we just, like, we did boss and we failed, right? Yeah. And that's a situation nobody wants to be in. So that's why it's so important. And, you know, during tabletops, generally, if they're facilitated at the executive level, things like that, generally you'll have a scribe that's assigned to just capture that stuff. Sure. Don't forget to do that during an incident. If you have the capability and the people to do it, right? Make sure someone is designated. Like, you're the person. Yeah. I need you to take the notes. Anything that we say, we should change this. Write that down. Yeah. And then we'll discuss it in a formal after action, post-mortem after. But during the midst of an incident, make sure someone is aware. Because everybody else, like, for the most part, people are going to be jobbing out and nobody's going to think, I should write this down. You know, some people may hear and there, but if you give someone the task, like, hey, you were the person writing the stuff down, then you're going to be in a good place.
Yeah.
A week or nine days from then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. I think you play how you practice, right? How you do one thing is how you do all things, right? So, you know, if you're going to have a scribe in your tabletop, you should absolutely have that. And that's a great, great example of, because again, during that 9 days, you know, the team was heads down. We were focused on the tasks that we were doing. We weren't necessarily thinking about when it was going to end, because we're putting out fires. Like, we're literally putting out fires, and you're not necessarily thinking, oh, well, that should be good to note for later. I mean, you think it, but you're not slowing down because it's on fire, right?
Yeah.
So you're trying to put the fire out.
Yeah.
That's your priority. But that, to your point though, if you have that designated person, and maybe it's just a text message, maybe it's a Teams chat, maybe it's a Slack channel, whatever your process is for that environment or for that incident, you know, some way to puff smoke and say, hey, this should be remembered for later. Make sure that we take note of this. This is going on, all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, there's a lot of things that go on in those spaces in a very short amount of time. And there's a lot of valuable information that needs to get documented. And it can't always be expected of every person to remember every important thing. And having that role, that designated role, and train your people on what to do and who that role is and what are the types of things that they should be, you know, bringing up to the top. That's hugely powerful. That's a great, great addition to make sure. So as you're listening to this, make sure that you're thinking about that in your incident response plans.
Absolutely.
Who's going to be that scribe in these when that incident does happen?
Because we all know that nobody can breathe until things are contained, right? I mean, that's the facts of life. Until you get past the containment stage, nobody's breathing. So do that early, right away. And then make sure that person understands, you know, the importance of it. So you'll have that great information afterwards.
The great thing about it, and we use that type of role in this as well, is they don't have to be a super technical person. So it's not like you have to take a technical person off the bench to bring in. It can literally be whomever that can take note is willing to show up and be part of the team, project managers, salespeople, you know, executives, managers, you know, any number of examples of scenarios of people that can be successful in that role. It's just, you need somebody that can fully focus on just that task, not the other things that they're doing to make sure that, you know, containment is done and the fire is put out, et cetera. And they're working on that documentation. That's a huge win. I think everybody should hear that. I know I just said that, but everybody should hear that. It's a super important thing, especially as an extended, you know, incident happens. There's a lot of moving parts. There can be 10, 20, 50, 100 people, maybe even more, at a large incident that could be. And if you're not working to make sure that you're getting those nuggets from all those different people, you're going to lose things. Things are going to slip through the cracks.
Yeah. If you have an associate level person, an intern, a rotational program person, like, that's great for them because they're going to learn stuff and they're going to contribute something significant to the team. And that's kind of how I've done it as well. So I had a rotational person and I attached him to everything that I could with the incidents, you know, and he was my eyes and ears when I was just head down into stuff. So it always works out great.
So talk to me about, so we talked about that, dude, I love that. That's a huge aha moment. What about after an incident? Let's talk about, you know, a big incident just happened. You just stopped the bleeding, you know, everything's restored, services are back up, you know, the team can now, slow down, you're coming back together. What are those big important next steps to really make sure that you're capturing that stuff and documenting it and finding the ahas? Like, what are those big tokens and items that you need to focus on during that time frame?
I think one of the things that I try to do is a blameless postmortem, as they say, right? It's never constructive to blame the team or the person that, you know,
malicious or
like obvious, like they meant to do it, right? Outside of that, though, blameless postmortem, you don't want to assign the blame to a person. You always want to try to assign it to a team, right? And it's not blame, but either way, you want to assign those improvement tasks to a team because it's generally not going to be on one person. It's generally going to be on the team. And even if it's not, it's their function, right? It's not the person. So I always try to start with that. And the second thing is you have to have a great way of tracking your lessons learned and a great way of tracking implementation and execution. Because a lot of people have, you know, a lot of times you'll have an incident, it ends, you're exhausted. Cool, we got our after action done, our blameless, you know, postmortem is done. And then the next thing we know, we're moving on to another one because something happens again, right?
Yep.
You know, any business, any big business, you're going to have that, right? So I think it's important to make sure that before you move into something else, you've got the lessons learned, you've got your notes, you've got your postmortem report. Throw that into something where you can track it that has visibility. Throw it in your own, you know, Jira instance or something like that where nobody else is visible. You can't assign to anybody, it's not helpful. But if you have a way to track that and give it visibility, you know that, because most of the time, if you're the incident response team, you're not the person that's going to implement a new group policy change, right? That's going to fix something that you found during an investigation. So you need to be able to track it, assign it, and then maintain visibility until it's implemented. So I think that's one of the things that's very important when you're talking about these lessons learned. They're precious resources that you have that you learned out of this incident. So treat them well, like it's money. Make sure it gets invested well, you know, so you don't just throw your money in the bank account and not track it. So same thing here. Track those things, well, make sure they get implemented.
I also love the blameless part, you know, coming from OT, you know, it's very similar to our safety culture, right? So we most OT environments have a safety culture, safety zero, you know, stop when unsure. You know, they really pound
it off
in your head. Yeah, absolutely. Right. They pound in your head. It doesn't matter who it is. It can be the plant manager. It can be the CEO. If they're doing something unsafe, tell them to stop. Right. You know, and it's blameless, you know, self-reporting, all that kind of stuff. It's not about getting any person in trouble. It's about, I want you to go home the same way you came to work in a safe way with all of your fingers and toes and all the things. So if I give you a thing that says, hey, you were working unsafe, it shouldn't be a punishment. It's not going to go in your employment file. That's going to be held against you come bonus time. You can't look at it that way. You want people to be able to self-report and show up, because if it's punitive, then you're not going to report your friends. You're not going to report people that you like, because you don't want it to go on their record. Then they're not going to like it. It's just, it's not a good environment. You're not building the environment to set up. In the same way in these incidents, you don't want to be pointing a finger and say, Daniel, you messed up. It should be, how did our process fail?
Right.
Daniel didn't fail. Like, why? How could we make sure that if the same thing happened again, Daniel wouldn't have chosen or wouldn't have made the same decisions and actions that he did? Because I don't want it to be a Daniel problem. I want it to be a process problem, a team problem, a leadership problem, because it all should roll uphill, not downhill. Like, you don't want to point it at that bottom person that maybe clicked the button or opened the valve or closed the valve or did whatever the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah.
Because again, then nobody's going to want to share. You're not going to have an open environment where people are going to feel comfortable to share the things that they saw, because they're going to be afraid they're going to get in trouble, or they're going to get their friend in trouble, or, you know, people are not going to like them. Like, inherently, that's not an environment that people are going to be open and willing to share information that you need in this scenario.
Yeah. And you have to build that into your culture. You know, you can't just do it when you're doing a postmortem, like, you can't just do it then. Yeah. We're not going to blame anybody. You got to build in your culture. It's got to be front and center of how you communicate, how you take suggestions, criticisms, improvement, recommendations, whatever it is. If you're a leadership in that organization, and like I said, that's how Rockwell is, you know, there's always an audience. So, and I'm not going to, you know, get smashed if it's something that's dumb.
Right.
So, it's just, okay, that's great, but it's probably not going to fit into where we're trying to move, you know, which is fine.
And that's okay. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. But
you want people to feel comfortable to bring up an idea and, you know, not be like the little kid in the back of the room that thinks they don't want to raise their hand because they're afraid they may have a stupid question or the answer may be wrong. You want them to say the wrong answer, because that makes it at least means that they're thinking. It means, at least means that they're trying to bring value. Again, maybe the thing that they're raising the hand about isn't going to help us today, but you want them to keep raising their hand, because you never know when one of those things that they raise their hand about is going to be the light bulb that everybody needed. And if you've beat them down by shut up, you're stupid, then they're not going to raise their hand anymore.
Yeah. And aviation culture is really great at that. As far as knock it off, anybody could say knock it off, you know, if there's a safety issue. I know in the Air Force, I'm not sure about, I don't know, civilian aviation, but in the Air Force especially, you know, it's always the option. So, and working in satellite communications, you had radiation hazards and stuff like that. So safety was always first with that, and electricity, you know, lockout, tag out and everything. So it's super important to be direct when things like that happen, but not blaming.
I think that's a critical piece that most organizations are not considering when they're building out their policies and procedures and their incident response and all that kind of stuff. Because, if, you know, to double click on that, right, is if you don't have that culture, people are not going to share. They're not going to be open. They are not going to be forthcoming with information. Maybe they're not going to hide information, but they're definitely not going to come forward with it unless they're directly asked, right? It's going to be, you're going to get a lot of stonewalling until you have information. But, oh yeah, yeah, that's right. Right. You want them to be coming forward because they trust, because you've shown and proven in the past that you're not going to, you know, come back on them. They trust that I can raise this and I can point this out, and it's not going to get Bobby fired. It's just going to say, hey, let's fix the process so that anybody in Bobby's situation wouldn't make that problem again, right? To your point, that takes time to build that culture. And if you don't have that culture, you need to start, and there's no better time to start than now. You need to start building that culture, because it's going to take that to be successful in one of these scenarios.
Yeah. And we've even had times where someone had realized they did something, you know, clicking on a phishing link or whatever. And then they reported it to us and, you know, just, you know, not long after. Right. And in that case, it's like, first thing we tell them is thank you, you know, for actually, you know, realizing what happened and then, and telling us about it. Even though we were already on the case, obviously with our tools and stuff, you still bringing it to us was important, because that means you're owning it and you want it to be better next time. And so we kind of recognize that person for doing something great, because that is great. If anybody in a plant or, you know, user on an IT environment, if you're reporting things that could lead to something not good, then you should be, you know, praised for that, because that is a courageous thing to do, just depending on or wherever you are. Right. So,
yeah. Absolutely. You know, sometimes you may report something that didn't get caught and nobody did see and they weren't aware of. So, so you never know when you report that phishing incident that people are going to be like that it's not an actual test and that it actually is a phishing thing and that nobody's seen it and you're the first person that's reported it. And it could stop others from clicking the link down the road, which could cause a bigger incident or issue, whether or not you clicked it or not. So all of these things, again, but this all comes back to, you know, beating up on the idea of you have to have a culture where people feel safe that they can do that. And there's not going to be retribution on them, right? Yeah, I made a mistake. I clicked a link. I promise you, everybody will click a link. Everybody. Because they're so good enough, and they're getting better. They're getting better. It's absolutely going to happen. You're going to click a link. So we need to have a culture where you want people to report, hey, I messed up. I clicked a link. It looked realistic. I didn't realize it until I clicked the link that it was not a place that I wanted to be. Please take a look at my system because I don't know if I'm impacted or not, or if I have a virus or malware or whatever's on here. So take a look at that, right?
You the other thing too is the other thing too is threat actors love to chain fish, right? So as soon as they get one person, they're going to send out, blast out emails and try to get other people within your organization. So if that person's reported it and they've lowered that time frame of the possibility of that, you're going to be a lot better off. Because 100%. If it gets out of hand and that person is chain phishing other people and then those people get compromised, obviously the blast radius is significantly more than if it's just the one person that you're able to lock down and reset quickly.
Yeah, I mean, and that's going to be the case in all different types of scenarios. It's the same thing if I, you know, I remember back in the day working on servers and, you know, being in a data center and having an old school key, you know, KVM and one of our guys was on the wrong server. So they thought they were on, you know, server one and they were supposed to be on server two. So they rebooted the wrong server. So they were patching and rebooting or whatever they were doing. They did the wrong one and they rebooted it. Well, that one was production and was actually had app, you know, live users and all the things on it. And they caused an outage. Ouch, but they didn't want to tell anybody because they didn't, A, at first they didn't realize it. And then B, when they did realize it, they're like, oh, I'll just get it back up and running before anybody notices. Right. Instead of saying, oops, I rebooted the wrong server. Let's be proactive about this and make sure that all of our users are back up. They didn't tell anybody because, again, they didn't want to get in trouble because they had not built a culture of, you know, being safe to share. I made a mistake because we all make mistakes. Mistakes are going to happen. We want to encourage you to admit when you made a mistake and let's fix it. I'm not going to be mad at Daniel. Let's just fix the problem and then figure out a way that we can make sure it maybe doesn't happen again. So we use back again, going back in the day, we put BG info on the desktop so that it would actually have the machine name and which device it was on. So when we're on the screen, because it's KVM, you know, you think you're on, you know, port one, you're on port two, but right on the desktop, it says the machine name. So it's just, you know, three ways of communication like we do and, you know, using the phonetic alphabet and three-way communication. I heard you say this. You want me to reboot that server one? Yes, please reboot server one. Okay, I'm rebooting server one. Like these are all tools that we use in the military. We bring those into these industrial spaces. IT doesn't always understand or experience those things because you don't necessarily use those in an IT space on a daily basis, but they're great processes and procedures. You know, we do, you know, pre-job briefs. You talked about lockout tagouts. Like these are all safety type minded environments, but it's the same thing in these systems to make sure that we're working on the right system. We're not bringing things down, you know, and we're building this culture of excellence in these environments. And you're peer checking, like all of these things are things that really bridge between IT, OT, military, government work, et cetera, to make sure that we're doing safely, effectively, you know, we're communicating well, you know, we're not making assumptions. Like we're all on the same page of what's going to happen. Okay, I'm going to click the button now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's two-person integrity is huge in the military, right? So it even rolls to cyber actions, right? Or cyber operations where you're not going to push a config to a firewall until someone else has checked it. Right. Yeah. Or ACL roles or whatever it is. Right. Yep. You're going to that person's got to check it before you push that. And that person has to be qualified on what they're looking at. So, correct. Once again, can't be just someone that's like the secretary. Hey, come over, take a look at this Palo Alto role. Please to make sure it's working before I push it. You're super helpful to have that no matter what kind of industry you're in. If it's a critical process, it never hurts to have another set of eyes on it.
Absolutely. You know, nobody's infallible. We've all been, it's late at night. Again, going back to the incident, right? You know, yeah. I was just in the UK for 9 days. Like, it's about day seven, not much sleep, you know, yeah. We're working 16 hour days. You know, we're in a strange country, eating strange food, sleeping in hotels, not getting great food, you know, yeah. All these things, you're going to be tired. You're going to miss things. Like, you're up at odd hours. You're drinking way too much caffeine. You're not eating great food. You're not at your house. Like, all of these factors are going to impact us. We're only human. So if you don't expect that your people are going to have issues, that's where peer checking comes in. That's where, you know, using phonetic alphabet, three-way communication, like double checking on all these things to make sure you don't make another mistake. Like, you're already in this incident. You don't want to have another one because your people are tired and they made a simple mistake that they probably wouldn't have made at the beginning of the shift, but it's 16 hours in and they're just trying to go home.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about the longer something goes on, you're eventually going to get to point, hopefully, you know, to restoration. And if you're not up on it during restoration or recovery, you know, you could end up setting yourself to going back to step one. So there's not good backups or you didn't check the backups, right? So, so you end up back to step one and starting all over, and nobody ever wants to do that twice, right? So
no, for sure. You know, and that's, I think, the theme that I hear, and it's funny, as we started talking and as I talk to everyone, I never have an agenda on these conversations. Like, I always just want to see where they go. But it's funny, obviously, your experience, it's natural that we kind of throttle down into this conversation. But it's funny, not everybody's had the experiences that you have and been on incident responses and had that level of understanding. So maybe they're writing an incident response, but they've never actually been on one. Maybe they've been in one. Maybe it was a simple one. It was a short one. But there's a lot of lessons learned that go into that that are valuable. And obviously, a lot of organizations are leaning on third parties, Rockwell being one of those that can help in incident response and following up, et cetera, right? But you still need to make sure that your team knows what's going on. Because again, as a third party coming in, I only know so much because I don't know your environment. Like, I'm leaning on your people to guide us on where the bodies are, where the critical systems are, what should be done, what. Like, obviously, we know cybersecurity, we know incident response, we know how to do those things, but we don't know the passwords, we don't know your systems, we don't know where the critical things are. We're leaning on you to be able to do that. So there's just so many nuggets that go into this. I think we could talk for hours on this topic.
Yeah.
And I think it's an important one. As we see more and more incidents that are coming up in OT, I think, unfortunately, more and more people are going to get experience in this space than probably really want to.
And I think one of the things, too, that we have a great team here, engineers, security engineers, analysts. And so, you know, just because you bring in a third party, too, doesn't mean they just stop, you know. Typically, our guys will keep going because they're driven like that. And so it makes it a lot better, though, because in the end product, you know, your third party will kind of give you their report, and then your other folks have kind of made it to the end, too. And so at that point, they can kind of compare notes and improve their own selves, right, or their training models and things like that. So it's really nice to have kind of both. And like you said, my folks are going to know how to get access to things, right? You guys coming in, it's going to be difficult. And that always seems to be the tough task when a third party comes in. It's like, how do I get access to these logs?
Yeah.
Number one question, right?
Important. Yeah, absolutely. How do I get access to the logs? How do I get access to the building? Like, sometimes, again,
yeah, that too.
The place I was just at, I needed an escort. And we had to have a person that could get us in these spaces. And are we authorized to go here? And could we take tools with us? And there were all of these other things that had nothing to do with the incident or cyber or any of that type of stuff. It was really just, I need somebody that can walk me into there because I can't get in there by myself.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this is one of the key things. And that's why it's helpful in our situation to have an incident commander, because those are all things that I'm thinking about while everybody else is, you know, face deep in a log. I might be thinking about, you know, we've got beginning to end for an incident. I don't know how it's going to go in the middle, but at least I know to start things off, there's going to need to be access requests, you know, that needs to be jumped on, you know, building access or whatever it is has to be done. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's just so many factors, especially as you start getting into a longer incident. It's one thing if it's a few hours, but you start talking about, you know, multiple teams, you talk about, you know, days, maybe even weeks of time.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you've stopped the outbreak, but now you're in recovery mode and you're kind of still, you know, covering up the Band-Aid or band-aiding the problem. It's not spreading, but it's still not resolved. It hasn't been, you know, squelched, whatever word you want to use there. But, you know, there's just so many things that go into that. And, you know, sometimes you just don't have visibility on everything. Again, like depending on the environment that you're in, you may not have comms to those people throughout the day. It may be at the end of the day before they can puff smoke because of where they're at. You know, you think about a renewable site in the middle of West Texas and there's no cell phone signal out there, right?
Yeah.
They're going to go out there and then 6 hours later, they're going to come back. Like you're not going to have any communications until they get back into town. Right. Yeah. So there's all these types of things that you need to think about as you're building out your plan and what's going to happen in those situations. Do they have, you know, radios? Do they have satellite communications? Like what are the things? Do they need it or can you do without them and let them go for 6 hours and then come back and puff smoke? Like these are things that you need to think about that goes beyond just what are my cybersecurity tools? What's in my toolkit? Because these are things that need to be considered in and above, you know, all of that. Like again, that West Texas site, how are people going to gain access? Do you have somebody that can escort them? Are they going to be able to get in the fence? What happens if it's after hours? Is there somebody on the weekend? Like what happens if the one person that has a key isn't available? What happens if he was the one that caused the like, there's just so many things that come up in this scenario. It's almost a never ending set of questions and answers of this, you know, choose your own adventure story that we are in incident response.
Yeah, I think that the military prepared me really well for that because especially one of the roles I had was, like I guess it was deployable stuff, right? So setting up, thinking about logistics and stuff like that ahead of time. You know, when you're going, okay, if I go to this country, we're using a credit card is probably not going to work. And even if it is, it's the government. So it's not a easy process to get a credit card to be used anywhere. Like, do I need to take cash? Do I need to go literally have someone go withdraw cash from the, you know, the base cashier cage? And we're going to take so many dollars with us so that if we need to buy something while we're there on the economy, you know, we can. And so if you're going to some country you've never been to before and you do some research and realize, you know, it may not be a reliable payment system, then maybe I need to think about taking cash with me, which is, you know, just so things like that always prepare me well to think the second, third order effects and things that you may not be thinking about once you're jumping into an incident.
Yeah, 100%. What other things, is there anything else that comes up for anybody that maybe hasn't been in an incident before? Maybe they have an incident response plan, but maybe they haven't tested it fully. Luckily, I guess is a better way to say that. And maybe what are some of those, we've already hit some pretty powerful nuggets here. Is there anything else that stands out that you think people should know or think about as they're practicing tabletops or they're writing their incident response or they're updating it? What is that? Anything come up?
Yeah, I think for practicing the tabletops, I think one of the things is, I don't know, don't be afraid to get crazy with it. And one of the things that's important to do as well, especially if you're going to have maybe non-IT people in there, that maybe from more of your business side, right? You've got to kind of tell them and try to do a primer at the beginning. Like the scenario was created by, you know, an AI engine or these group of people at the company. Don't fight the scenario. So if something sounds ridiculous to you, don't just fight. Don't dwell on that one nugget, right? Like, there's no way that would happen. You know, I remember one of the scenarios that we had to run when I was in the military was, hey, a small aircraft is going to crash into this satellite antenna. And then how are you going to communicate with that satellite after that? You know, it's like, that would never happen. You know, we've got jets and things and all this stuff that protects us, you know, around military bases. It's like, but, and so everybody's trying to fight it. And then they're like, they say, yeah, don't care. Okay. Well, if it's a tornado, what if it's hail? You know, it could be anything, but tell me what you're going to do if that happens and actually think through that. So I think I always start with some of these details may not make sense or may not even be, you know, super realistic, but even then you're going to run through the process. You're still going to get something beneficial out of it because you're still got to run through your process, no matter if it's a tornado, sharknado, whatever's, you know, hitting your building, or it's a super, you know, high tech threat actor that's jumping in your network and using his massive, you know, important tool on your network, right? No matter what, you still got to follow your process to get from containment to recovery. a restoration.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if you go through some of those scenarios and they're so far-fetched, you're like, yeah, I don't think we need to include that in our incident response plan. The likelihood of that is so low. But at least just having that conversation and not making an assumption, bring it up. Have a dialogue,
yeah.
Make sure everybody agrees, and then you parking lot it. Like, hey, we didn't include this. It wasn't because we didn't think about it. It was just because it's so far-fetched that it's not high enough a priority to put in our list, right? So there's no way you can ever instant response plan have a response for everything. It would be so complex and so long, it would just be useless. So you need to prioritize, but that doesn't mean you don't bring them up, right? You should have the dialogue and have the conversation, because weird things happen. Like,
nothing ever surprises me. It's just like, that's today, you know, like, okay, this is crazy, but we're going to move forward and fix it.
Substations get shot by deer rifles and drunk people run into things and, you know, helicopters land inside protected areas at nuclear power plants because they're looking for real estate and think this is it. I mean, I've seen some crazy stuff happen. You're just like, really? Like, you have your pilot's license and you landed inside a protected area. At a nuclear power plant that has a no-fly zone a long ways around it, and you landed inside the protected area, my gosh, here's your sign.
Yeah, may not have the license long.
I don't think you have a license anymore. I think they revoked that. The FAA said, yeah, not anymore.
yeah, that's wild. But yeah, nothing ever surprises me. I never know what I'm going to face, you know, day to day, which honestly keeps it interesting. That's why I like it, you know, so it's always spontaneous. So it's good.
Yeah. Incident responses can be a lot of fun. Obviously they're stressful. They can be a lot of work. They could be crazy hours, all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, it's really cool at the end of it, when you take that breath and you're like, wow, we just went through this and this is the outcome that we got. That was interesting. And, you know, that was a lot of fun. And yeah, my gosh, that was stressful, but man, that was really cool as well. You get some cool, you know, war stories around the thing that you just fought through together as a team.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I've always tried to do is to maintain perspective when I was in the military. And you know, at the end of the day, even if it was a stressful day, things were tough. You go, did anybody die today? Right. No.
Yeah.
So it's not as bad as it could get, right?
Sure. Yep.
So no matter what has happened that day, and I kind of, you know, learned this, like I said, through some of the super stressful times in the military, it's like, but nobody died. So yeah, that communication's not functioning right now, or so we can't communicate with someone we need to, or maybe we did not test our backups and we've restored and put malware back in there. But in the end, we're going to get through it, right? And if you look at perspective, worst case scenario, you're probably going to be left of that 99% of the time. And if you're not, that's just a different story altogether. So it's okay.
Yeah, 100%. So this has been a fun conversation. So in the next, I asked everybody this question, I gave you a warm up of this, but you know, next 5 to 10 years, what's one thing you see come up over the horizon that's concerning and maybe another thing that's exciting?
I think one of the things that's concerning to me, and it's probably one of those things that everybody's going to kind of talk about, right? It's not just not artificial intelligence, but the embracing of that from threat actors. And when we're talking about OT, I'm not talking about, oh, it creates a really cool phishing email or something like that. But I think the more these models learn, the more sophisticated threat actors are going to learn about OT environments. Because one of the things that I took the grid class, right, and I got to take it through from Rob, who taught it, which was great. But one of the things that he talked about was, you know, threat actors are, there's OT environments can be, you know, very complicated and very different depending on where you go. So if you look at the attacks that have been in the past in the scenarios, they'll get in the environment and it takes them a bit to learn. They have to learn about how things are set up, learn about the process, learn about the products and stuff like that. Because it's such a vast pool of knowledge that you would need to know that it takes time. And so I think with AI, once it gets well-trained on OT or whatever it is, right, it's going to be a lot easier to learn. So mess around with it just like everybody does, right? And Copilot can do a lot to help teach you things really quickly. And so I think that's one of the things that's concerning for me as it relates specifically to OT is what is it going to look like once resources just spent on learning things like that, right? Processes, products and things like that, where they're not having to go to 20 different resources to find this information. They can go to one.
Yeah, 100%.
And then as far as the exciting things, I've been doing a lot with AI agents and stuff like that. I think that those could be helpful for various tasks, right? But I think one thing that everybody's scared about, right, is like taking jobs and stuff like that. And so I think that when you're thinking about the agents, agentic AI, right, things like that, it's important to think about what are the things that still need the human in the loop, and focusing on making the human more prepared and smarter on what they're looking at, right? So it kind of goes along with the bad side, but the good side is if you're someone who wants to learn about, you know, digital twins or something like that, or spacecraft, it's going to be a lot quicker. So I'm excited about what that's going to mean for the defense side too, as far as us learning more about it. Because I think that when I came into Rockwell, I didn't have any, you know, product experience or anything like that. So it took a while for me to get up to speed on what all of our products were. And I still don't know everything, obviously, because we make thousands of things, right? And software, yeah. Right? But I have familiarity with most things. And so I think if I could have just sat, you know, with some agentic AI that had all of our manuals and all that stuff in there, and could have summarized some of that stuff for a week, it would have been a lot faster than, you know, osmosis over working on things.
Right.
So I know the token answer is AI, but honestly, it's just what it is right now. So
yeah.
So I think that's good and bad, right? Exciting and not exciting at the same time. Well,
to your point, like the good guys can use it to level up their game. The bad guys can use it to level up their game. So if the bad guys are going to use it, and you know they're going to, so we have to be using it because they are. So we have to be making sure that we're training our people, that we're plugging it in. Obviously, we got to be intentional about it and careful where we're plugging it in and what we're doing with it, because obviously we can add risk. There was an article today where, you know, China just there was an incident where they did a full autonomous attack using AI.
Yeah, through Anthropic. Right, so. I read that yesterday. Yeah, it's fascinating using MCP agents and stuff like that. Yeah. So.
But that's the future, right? It's going to be the AIs are going to be attacking us, not even necessarily a human. The APTs are going to be like, yeah, go after, you know, Daniel at Rockwell. Just don't give up until you find a way into his world, right? They don't sleep. They don't eat. Like, it's the Terminator movie, but it's a cyber side, right? He doesn't eat. He doesn't sleep. He doesn't get tired. They won't stop until they get to the result that they're looking for. That can be the future. But on the flip side, we can also use that in an offensive way where it's constantly looking for those things and protecting and doing all that type of stuff. So I agree with you. A lot of times folks' answers is that, but it's always a different perspective. So I appreciate that because it's not the same. Like, it's a different why of why they're bringing up AI, why it's important to them, and what perspective they see from it, from a good and bad perspective. Even though they're similar, they're all very different. So I still appreciate that. So
yeah, and if you think about the pace it's going, like what? Yeah. I mean, 5 years is an eternity when you think about the pace it's going.
That's why I've almost thought about not asking the question the way that I do. I've been asking it that way since the beginning, but 10 years, multiple people will be like, I have no idea in 10 years. Hell, I don't even know necessarily in five, but 10 years is way too far out to imagine.
Yeah.
Because things are changing so fast. In a year, it's going to be drastically different than it is today, probably beyond what you and I can anticipate, even because it's growing exponentially beyond what we can imagine. So,
right. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe when you think about when I was a teenager, the computer I had, you know, the 8086, right? It was the first computer I got.
Yeah.
And then I went to the 486. The next thing you know, it's a 1 gigahertz processor. And that was within like 3 or 4 years, you know.
And now we have these devices that
are nowadays
2 terabytes and, you know, GPUs and CPUs and multiple cores and, you know, gigabit Ethernet and directly up and down satellite, like all the things. Like, it's just exponentially more. You know, you got console wars where Steam Decks are going to be going against consoles, and it's just everything is changing, some for the better, some for the I don't know, we'll see, but
so I think it's going to be interesting. 5 years is an eternity when it comes to the way technology is moving. So
100%.
So it'd be cool to see.
Well, awesome, man. So any call to actions for anybody? Come see you speak, come check out a white paper, anything like that you want people to know about you or to reach out, etc.
I'm not speaking at S4, but I'm going to be at S4. So I'd love to, you know, catch up with everybody. I love the conference. It just feels like family, you know. I always see people I know there and hang out. So I may have some stuff that I'm going to submit for call for papers this upcoming year. So if that comes out, keep an eye on it. It's a bit dated, but I spoke at SANS ICS in 2024. So definitely encourage you to go check that out. Very interesting case we had at Rockwell for a capability that was being developed that our government partner told us about in the midst of it being developed. So we were able to kind of cut that off before it was released. and get everybody protected. So, but yeah, Very cool. Other than that, yeah, connect on LinkedIn and it's great talking to everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking time and talking with me today. Definitely come see me at S4 because I'll be there as well. So definitely Awesome. Grab a beer, coffee, cigar, whatever the thing is. And always like putting a face to a in person shaking a hand of people that I met with here. So again, thank you again so much for your time. Great conversation. I really appreciate it. Definitely some big nuggets that we hit in today around incident response. And I think they're hugely valuable for people to take in and really implement in their environments and maybe even reach out if they need some questions or help. So thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Again. Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us on Protect It All, where we explore the crossroads of IT and OT cybersecurity. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to stay ahead in this ever-evolving field. Until next time.